You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the race is tightening in the matchup between Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson for the U.S. Senate. We'll get the latest. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, The Guardian U.S. published 1,500 pages of leaked court documents from the John Doe investigation in Wisconsin. The investigation centered on potentially criminal campaign finance violations by Governor Scott Walker's campaign committee for his recall election. That investigation was eventually ended. Still some court action going on there. Robert Mentzer joins us now to talk about this and other top news stories from around Wisconsin this week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he joins us once a week for a look at the top stories in the news. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, a lot of stuff in these documents. People have picked them apart, looked at different things. What struck you most about what we've seen so far?
Well, it's been a feast, right? I mean, for if you follow Wisconsin politics, it's obviously it's been the biggest story of this week. And one of the things that makes it irresistible is that it's just it's a peek behind the curtain of Wisconsin politics as it is actually practiced. So you know, Central Time has had a bunch of guests on to talk about different stories, and there are a number of big and interesting stories that come out of this. But one of the things that I did find most interesting or interesting in a way that was reported on this week is this matter of Republican operatives emailing the morning after the 2011 state Supreme Court election, saying that this was a close election, and they were ginning up right away, saying that they should, quote, start messaging widespread reports of election fraud in the wake of the election. And what was notable about it was that there were no such reports of widespread election fraud. No one ever in the email ever refers to actual instances, or even forget actual instances, just not even actual reports. Yet they all sort of agreed unanimously that this is a good message to go with, and it seems pretty cynical. And I think it's been pointed out as a pretty cynical bit of a manipulation.
Now, what kind of reactions have you seen since this Guardian report with all these leaked documents?
Well, so the reaction is all over and depends on the which aspect of the documents we're talking about, right? In general, the Republican reaction has been this leak is illegal, which is probably true. The person who leaked it did so apparently in direct violation of a judge's or the Wisconsin Supreme Court's order to destroy documents related to the investigation, and so they try to say that they try to sort of not answer questions on the substance of what's in the documents. Governor Walker, to the extent that he has responded to them, says this is old news. There were no charges brought against me, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court dismissed all of this and took a very strong position that the Walker campaign's fundraising activities were fine, what they did. So, I mean, that's the response, but it's just, again, there's just something interesting and I would say valuable about seeing inside how the sort of sausage is made and the way that these politicians behave when they think that no one is looking.
And one thing a lot of people have been talking about was the extent to which Governor Walker himself appears to have been raising money, not just anyway for his own campaign, which would have been disclosed donations, but for the Wisconsin Club for Growth, where these donations, until this leak, might never be disclosed.
Right, precisely, and referring directly to that as a pitch point that they would make to donors, to make the pitch that these no one has to know about these donations, so this won't embarrass you. Walker was engaged directly in raising funds for Wisconsin Club for Growth, which is, of course, supposedly the conceit had been that it is an independent issue group, but there were documents showing that he referred to that he I forget the language, but that he scored a $1 million donation or whatever, so showing or heavily implying that he was directly raising funds for this group that supposedly his campaign was not supposed to coordinate with.
We'll keep watching the fallout on that. We're talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in the news this week. Let's move on to another one involving Governor Walker. He introduced his transportation funding plan. Policy nerds have been watching for this for a while. What was in the plan, Rob?
So this is the big debate. This is the big fight in the last state budget, and it's going to be a big fight in the next state budget. Governor Walker, what he essentially does is save a bunch of money by delaying some big state highway programs. There's a few specific programs. The Verona Road project down by where you guys are in the Madison area, there's a delay of a big interstate expansion project through Racine and Kenosha County. And, of course, the north leg of the Zoo Interchange in Milwaukee, which is a big expensive project. So that saves a lot of money. The governor's budget would borrow about $500 million, and then what it would do, and this is where it sort of gets interesting, is Walker's budget would increase funding for local governments, for local roads, to the tune of $65 million, and it commits $605 million for county and state road maintenance, which is both of which are an increase from where the last budget is.
Those big projects, though, some people are wanting to see those happen. What kind of reaction have you gotten from Republicans in the legislature who were open, at least in the assembly, to revenue increases, which the governor was not?
So I think this is really where you see the political tension within the Republican Party. So the big highway projects, the people who really care the most about those tend to be trucking businesses, transportation lobbyists, members of the business community. That's not to denigrate that. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of commerce that moves on the state's biggest highways. But those are the groups that really want to see those highway expansions. Now, if you talk to people, they tend to be most annoyed about like the potholes on their local road down the street from the grocery store or whatever. And so I think this is where the tension exists. I think that's likely the reason that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss came out immediately against Walker's budget, called it a political solution, not a real solution to state funding for highways. It's interesting because it really does, in a real sense, it puts Walker at odds with the state's business and transportation lobbying groups, which is not necessarily a place that he's accustomed to being.
And Rob, before we wrap up, I want to get to this Wolf Summit up in northern, northern Wisconsin? People from Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan talking about wolf management. What do we see from that?
Yeah, northwestern Wisconsin. We'll count it. It's northern Wisconsin. Cumberland is where it was held. So this was a summit hosted by State Senator Tom Tiffany, who in our photos, he was sporting a nice howling wolf bolo tie, which was a nice wardrobe choice for the event, and Representative Adam Jarko. So they both want to see, and the purpose of this summit really was to further, they want to see wolves delisted from the endangered species list and population control returned to state governments. This was the case, and Wisconsin already has on its books laws that would allow farmers to kill wolves that threaten livestock and that would allow a wolf hunt to go on. That happened from 2012 to 2014, and then in 2014 a federal judge restored the wolf to the endangered species list, so that sort of trumped those state laws. These are people who say that the wolves are a hazard. There's a bunch of wolves. They're behind every tree. They're doing damage to our livestock. And in fact, it's documented wolves have killed already 32 people's hunting dogs. And so they say that they should be, there's a lot of wolves and they should be controlled.
Rob, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us.
Right. Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us each week to round up the top state news stories of the week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the state of education in Wisconsin. First, early on in this election season, the seat of Republican Senator Ron Johnson was considered one of the most vulnerable in the nation. Polling from August showed Russ Feingold, with a big lead, but more recent polls show the race getting tighter. Feingold and Johnson have been sparring over ethics allegations, national security, and who's the better champion of the middle class. Veronica Rickard checked in with UW La Crosse political scientist Tim Dale about how the race is shaping up.
Tim, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, Tim, first, as the race stands today, who's ahead, Ron Johnson or Russ Feingold?
Well, right now it looks like Feingold's enjoying a few percentage points lead. In fact, about a month ago, Feingold had as much as a double-digit lead, but the polls have now come closer. We'll definitely get a better picture of the race. As this month goes on, there should be a couple other polls that we'll be seeing, but right now it looks like Feingold's in the lead by a few points.
Now, as a political scientist, you look at that. What occurs to you about what might have caused this shift so far in this campaign?
Well, as elections get closer, the polls tend to narrow. And we kind of know that the electorate is split nearly evenly in terms of those who identify Democrat and those who identify Republican. The trend this year probably will follow previous years where we've seen a presidential election. Turnout is going to be higher. And so part of the difficulty in taking polls is that you have to model turnout. And so the number of people who are going to be voting in the election actually is going to have an impact on who wins and also has an impact on how the polls look from poll to poll.
Now, the biggest story recently is that both candidates are attacking each other on ethics complaints. So let's start with Ron Johnson's campaign. What is he saying about Russ Feingold's campaign for Senate?
Well, Feingold worked for the State Department for a period of time, and it is not legal to campaign for office using State Department email accounts and when you're working for the government. And so the Johnson campaign is alleging that there was a kind of shadow campaign going on while Feingold was working in the State Department. And so actually with echoes to the presidential race, the Johnson people are asking for emails to expose what they believe to be inappropriate actions that Feingold took while he was working at the State Department.
And is there any chance of them getting these emails before the election?
No, probably not. In fact, on both issues that the campaigns are pushing right now about the other, they look like they would not be resolved before the election. In fact, it looks more like it's just going to be a lot of talk about potential problems or ethic complaints. We're really not going to get the final details until after the election.
Now, as for Feingold, his campaign is accusing Ron Johnson of violating ethics law with a $10 million payout. What's the story there?
Right. Well, Johnson donated about $9 million to his campaign. And then as he was leaving his business to go work in the Senate, he was paid $10 million as kind of a retirement or leaving business bonus. Democrats and Feingold's campaign are asking that this be looked at as the possibility that he was actually paying himself back for loans to his campaign, which would not be okay under campaign financing laws.
So how does that one go forward?
Well, again, this is just like the Feingold thing. If there is an investigation, which there could be, it is going to be a long, involved process. These things aren't ever resolved within a matter of months. And so this really will be a matter really of connecting it to broader arguments that are being made about the candidates as opposed to this particular issue being resolved before the election.
And in the meantime, what has the Johnson campaign said about that $10 million payout?
Right. Well, they're saying that it was reported when it happened and that it was part of him leaving, that he didn't take a paycheck for a period of time when he was running the company, and so that it was his compensation for the work that he had done previously.
And as far as Russ Feingold and the allegation of a sort of a shadow campaign that started early, has he spoken out about that?
They're denying that it was happening. They're denying that he was running his campaign while he was working at the State Department. And so their allegation or their response is much like Johnson's response, which is that this is all both allegations are an attempt to distract from bigger issues that are really at play in the campaign.
So aside from those ethics complaints, national security has been a pretty big talking point in these campaigns so far, at least. And they have very different approaches to issues like ISIS and how to handle the problems in Syria and the refugees. What are both sides saying there?
Right. Well, and this is another way in which there are some ways in which Johnson and Feingold are different from the presidential candidates, but this is one where they are similar. Johnson wants a much more strict policy on refugees. Johnson is interested in a much more aggressive foreign policy stance. Feingold is taking a different view. Feingold is more interested in the United States being kind of that beacon of hope for refugees, and also dealing with ISIS in ways similar to what Hillary Clinton is suggesting. And so in this, they are closer to the presidential candidates.
And both have been accusing the other of being ill-prepared to take on this issue of national security. How is that unfolding?
Right. Well, this is actually where those kind of principled disagreements are filtering into the more personal attack of a person who is not prepared. And so but with Johnson being Homeland Security as his one of his major committee assignments, he's arguing that he is better prepared to deal with the threats to Homeland Security. Feingold, of course, was in the Senate for three terms previously, and so has done a lot with national security, and is making some of the same arguments we heard 6 years ago that Feingold made against Johnson, that he is not bringing in basically the lifetime experience that Feingold has.
We're talking with UW La Crosse professor Tim Dale right now, talking about the Senate matchup between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold. And Tim, you mentioned the presidential candidates and how they might align with these two when it comes to their Senate race and their positions there. And it's an interesting race because you have two presidential candidates who have both of them remarkably high unfavorable ratings. So how closely are these two candidates, Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, how closely are they aligning themselves with the presidential candidates?
Well, one of the more interesting things that is happening during this election season, and it's actually among several interesting things, is that you have both Johnson and Feingold in Wisconsin polling better than their presidential nominee. And so what's interesting about what the candidates are arguing now and the campaigns are arguing now is that they're trying to link the other to their party's nominee. That's kind of the opposite of what we usually see, which is a candidate happily linking themselves to the party's nominee. And so you have Johnson accusing Feingold of being more like Clinton and Feingold accusing Johnson of being more like Trump. I think that there's an interesting parallel that might be drawn between this race for Senate and President and Feingold's first run at the Senate in 1992. That's actually the last time that we had a presidential race really be this close to unpopular for both candidates. Both Bush and Clinton in 1992 earned close to 40% in Wisconsin, and Feingold and his opponent Bob Casting, who was the incumbent, were both close to 50% in their final polling. And so I think we will see perhaps some parallels and echoes of that race where the presidential candidates in Wisconsin may get as low as 40%, someone winning 41 to 39 or something like that in Wisconsin, with the Senate race much closer to 51-49.
Have we seen, for instance, Johnson campaigning with Donald Trump or referencing him a lot, and the same with Feingold so far?
Not as much, and this is part of that dynamic where if the presidential candidate is less popular than the Senate candidate, then we see the Senate candidate sometimes distancing themselves, not necessarily making public appearances. Where there has been some linking is in terms of an attempt at fundraising, and so Johnson has certainly referenced Trump, has said that Trump is a better choice than Hillary, particularly when he's appearing at fundraising events. Same with Feingold, clearly endorsing Hillary Clinton and saying that Clinton is a better choice than Trump. But in a race like this, when the polls are where they are, there is some distancing that typically happens.
So what is the fundraising looking like for both these candidates right now?
Well, Johnson is outraising Feingold right now. And part of the reason for that, this is another interesting thing that links to the presidential race, is that there are a lot of big donors to Republican causes, or typically Republican causes, who are not donating to the Trump campaign. And so we see this actually happening across the country, and Johnson's a really good example of this, where big Republican donors are actually putting their money toward the Senate races, seeing that as a really significant consequence or potential consequence to this fall's election, and not putting the money in the presidential race. So that is probably one of the major reasons why Johnson is out raising Feingold right now, because of those donors.
That's interesting, because I know early on the Senate seat of Ron Johnson was considered one of the most vulnerable in the nation, and you had things like ad money being pulled for the Johnson campaign. So is that turning around now? Is he being seen as a stronger candidate to put if you're looking for some a Republican candidate to back in Wisconsin? Is that looking like a strong bet?
Well, Johnson's a stronger candidate than he was seen about a month ago, and that's because the most recent poll has him coming closer to Feingold. I think that when the money was pulled from the state, that was the Republican Party taking some money out, which is a different consideration sometimes where the party is going to put their money versus where donors put their money. I think the other thing that is a factor here is that some of the other Senate races have gotten a lot closer that look like they may be going for Democrats, and so rather than the Senate looking like it was more probably going to be picked up by the Democrats, it looks like the Senate is going to be very close, maybe even a 50-50 split. That makes races like the Wisconsin race even more significant, because if it is going to be a 50-50 split, a race like Wisconsin's will tip it in one direction or the other.
And what is the advertising campaign looking like for both sides?
Well, we're seeing both positive and negative ads. And I'm sure people have been seeing these as they watch football on TV or the news. There are some ads that are introducing us to the candidates again, Feingold being out of office for 6 years, and Johnson also kind of reintroducing people to him and his candidacy. But, of course, we also see the negative advertising, which is where research shows historically that that has the biggest impact in terms of influencing people's vote. So we're getting right now kind of a mix of the positive, here's what I'm going to do for the country, and also the attack ads that we're used to seeing.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Tim Dale. He's a professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. He joined us to talk about the Senate race between incumbent Republican Ron Johnson and Democrat and former Senator Russ Feingold. Coming up, we'll talk to the state superintendent of public instruction about the state of education here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Ken and his guests look at some of the most pivotal debates in American presidential campaign history and some of the best debate parodies from Saturday Night Live. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, education is frequently touted as a top priority here in the state. Wisconsin is home to more than 867,000 students enrolled in public school in 2015, ranging from kindergarten to seniors in high school. But Wisconsin faces a number of challenges, between reaching the needs of children of color to low teacher salary, staffing shortages, and funding cuts in a complicated school funding formula. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers addressed legislators yesterday at the state capitol. He joins us now. Superintendent Evers, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot, Rob, and happy Friday.
And to you, too. Well, you talked a lot about three groups of students, English language learners, children in poverty, and children with disabilities. Why was this an important focus in your address yesterday?
Well, it's an extremely important focus because several years ago, the Supreme Court took a look at our funding formula and indicated that there's like three groups of students, the three you mentioned, are kind of our canaries in the mine, because if the funding isn't adequate for those three areas, and frankly other areas where kids are struggling, our constitutionality of the funding system can be called into question. But more importantly, if kids are in a position that they need additional help and an extra lift, we have to make sure that we're prioritizing resources towards serving that.
So what kind of things can we do to prioritize those resources?
Well, some of the things that I planned when we submit our budget to the governor and his staff at the Department of Administration is one. It's inside poker in a way, but there's a large amount of money in the one categorical aid program. It's called per pupil categorical aid. And right now, it's given out evenly to school districts across the state. It's an equal amount per student. And I'll be proposing that it be weighted according to some kids in need, including we're going to put a weighting for foster kids that are struggling in poverty and so on, and weight those. And so the districts that have more of those children, more of the expenses of those children to get them to give them an extra lift, they'll get more than those districts that don't. But we're asking for an increase enough that it will no one will get less than they did the previous year per kid. So that's one, and that's an important one. It sends a message that we need to prioritize equity in the state, and that's a critical issue across the country, but that's certainly here. So that's one area we're looking at, areas of mental health and making sure that our teachers, especially in rural schools, we continue to have great staffing there.
We'll get into that in a bit more, the teacher shortage idea. But I wanted to stick with the idea of courts and schools. You mentioned that. We saw Connecticut not that long ago, a court there saying, hey, state, you have to fix your school funding formula. There are have schools and have not schools. You need to make it more equitable. How are we doing here in Wisconsin? Do we have a system where some schools have a lot of money and can provide a lot of educational opportunity, others can't?
Well, absolutely, and we are becoming a state of haves and have-nots. Since the state has kind of dialed back their investment in public schools, K-12 public schools, more and more districts are going to referenda at alarming rates. And the great thing is they're passing at high rates. 80% of the people of the state are saying, since the state isn't providing adequate amount of money, we will tax ourselves more to cover that shortfall. Well, that's wonderful, but that's not the way the Constitution's set up. And then we also have 20% of those districts that don't pass referenda. And, you know, they are the have-nots. I mean, if your children and grandchildren were in those districts, I would wonder, you know, are they getting the best education? I'm sure that there's some inequities there that we need to resolve.
The state has a formula for how it funds schools, how it takes property tax money in particular and distributes it among school districts. It's a complicated system. Do you think it needs to be rethought out, reformed, changed?
Well, absolutely. It's been broken since I've been in public education, which is about close to 40 years now. So absolutely it's broken. And, you know, a couple of things are a problem. One is that the surrogate for wealth in the formula is property, and it's not income. And so if you're a district up north that has lots of resort and high property value, excuse me for stumbling there, they get less state aid. And in those districts, income is not high. In fact, it's very low. So that's unfair, but the system itself is exceedingly complex, and there's only a handful of people in the state that really know it well, frankly. But what we have to do is, in the meantime, before people provide some leadership here in the legislature, we need to fix what's existing. And the proposals that I have, I believe, will get us in the right direction. The other part of it is, of course, the general aid that all school districts get. That also needs to be changed to reflect our need in our state it's our moral compass to make sure that kids that are struggling get that extra lift. And I think all our systems need to be viewed through that lens.
We're talking to Tony Evers, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. He delivered an address on the state of education here in Wisconsin yesterday. Just have a couple more minutes with you, Superintendent Evers. You brought up concerns about teacher shortages in schools, especially in high needs areas. What is Wisconsin seeing?
Well, it is difficult, and there's data to support that. The teachers across the country, by a study by the Policy Institute, indicated that they earn 17% less than their equal peers that are college educated. So the amount of I think they're undercompensated for starters. But the scary thing is that, you know, we have a little bit of the Wild West out there where districts, some districts can pay more and get teachers from smaller school districts that pay less. Some of their high flyers and coming to the suburban or wealthier districts. And then the rural districts are sitting there trying to find the people to replace them. And it's just extraordinarily difficult in special education, English learners, teachers that work with them, and also career and technical education teachers. We're at a real tipping point here, and we really need to look at the ways to correct that.
You talked about more funding from the state for higher teacher pay. Governor Walker's office said we gave schools the tools to pay high performers, merit pay, that sort of thing. That's the tool they need to attract and retain teachers. What do you say?
Yeah, well, those tools have been used once, and there's no more tools in the toolbox. And so those small rural districts that lose really quality and highly coveted teachers are moving out. And what are they supposed to do? Take more money out of the present staff's pockets? Say, geez, well, we have to cut back your pay so that we can do merit pay to get people here. I mean, those tools have been used once. They can't be used a couple times over. They kind of disappear after the first year. So it is a problem. And if I was a parent or a grandparent in a rural school that's losing teachers, and I heard it from Southwest Wisconsin. I was just down in a school district down there. They're losing teachers to Dubuque and Platteville and other districts and larger districts, and they are having a hard time replacing people. Now, is that fair to that school district? They've used all the tools. And, of course, in the past, those tools really were cutting back on teacher salaries, cutting back on their benefits. So it came out of everybody's pocket. You can't reach into those pockets again.
And you mentioned in your address yesterday providing some money to rural districts to help attract and retain teachers in the short term. But you say it's not just money if we want to bring people into teaching. There's an attitude out there toward teachers. Can you leave us with some thoughts on that?
Sure. I absolutely believe that there's one free thing that we can do to get more people interested in the profession, especially young people. And we see that playing out in our schools of education, is we need to change the negative rhetoric around schools and around teachers. There seems to be, and I hear it from young people that are in college, they don't want to go into a profession where they're going to have a target on their back. And we have to change the rhetoric, and that's easy. People locally like their teachers and support them. But at the state level and the national level, we need to do more to honor the profession. They're working harder than ever, and they're achieving as well or better than ever. So it's time to recognize that and change the rhetoric. It's free.
Superintendent Evers, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob.
That's Tony Evers, State Superintendent of Public Instruction in Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about the state of education. Coming up, we'll talk to Alan Borsuk with Marquette Law School. He's a longtime education writer. More on the state of Wisconsin schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are schools like in Wisconsin? What are schools like in your community? What needs to change? What can improve? If you're a teacher, what do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. More on education coming up on Central Time in just a few moments. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We are continuing our conversation about education in Wisconsin. We just heard from Tony Evers, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. He delivered his State of Education in Wisconsin address yesterday. Alan Borsuk joins us now, Senior Fellow of Law and Public Policy at the Marquette University Law School. He's covered education issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, a member of the community, what would you like to see change in Wisconsin schools? If you you are in education yourself. What is it like in your school district today? Are you seeing teacher shortages where you are? Or are you not? What is the solution? If so, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Alan Borsuk, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, what were your thoughts on what Superintendent Evers had to say today or at his address yesterday?
Well, he's outlining some broad themes. In fact, he was starting to get more specific in some of the comments right here than he was in the actual speech yesterday, this business of changing the categorical funding to direct it more towards high-needs areas, for example. The real battle is going to begin when he makes his budget proposals to the governor and the Department of Administration, and then, of course, when it hits the legislature come about February. Superintendent Evers has been in favor of increasing education spending in the last several budget cycles, and of course that hasn't sold too well once it hits the legislature and the Republican majorities there. And what's going to happen this coming spring is going to be both really crucial and, from a reporting standpoint, really interesting to watch.
Yes, Superintendent Evers hoping to get some money restored, even if the schools don't come out ahead after cuts. And we've heard, I think, Governor Walker and some in the legislature say, yeah, one of our priorities is to get some funding back to the schools. What kind of things are we hearing?
Well, there's been a shift in Governor Walker's comments on this going back to the state address last January, that he seems to be increasingly aware that there's some legitimate spending issues and finance issues related to school districts all over the state. I think one of the reasons he's hearing this is because schools in Republican districts, it's not just Madison and Milwaukee, it's statewide that they're saying we are really strapped. And I think there's some recognition of that. There's some political acknowledgement of it. What that's going to translate into in terms of dollars and how to parcel out these dollars, that's really unknown at this point.
I want to bring in a caller now. We've got Jamie on the line in River Falls. Jamie, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to say, Jamie?
Well, I just wanted to respond to some of the earlier comments regarding Tony Evers mentioned shortage in teacher applicants and the kind of rhetoric surrounding education in general, and wanted to chime in to say locally in River Falls, we certainly have seen a decline in the number of applicants for some of our teaching positions, certainly not all, but there is a growing number of concerns within the teaching profession regarding the number of people that are interested in going into the field of teaching. And I think that our public media and the perception that people have regarding the teaching profession has fed into some negativity that needs to be addressed.
And Jamie, do you work in the district there?
I am the superintendent of the district, yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jamie, for sharing your firsthand experience there. Alan, are there a lot of administrators in Jamie's schools that you've heard of that are worried about hiring the teacher, especially maybe that teacher for a very specific kind of class?
Well, it's mostly in specific areas, as Dr. Evers was saying, special ed, high school math and science, bilingual, some of those areas where there is a bigger shortage. But frankly, I've seen very little in the way of numbers as far as actual openings at the moment. If I can be a little less politically correct, perhaps, there's a second aspect to this. It's not only just the numbers. Are you going to find people to be teachers in the classrooms? Because they're still okay jobs. They could be treated with way more respect, which is an important theme. But the question also is who's being attracted. Is it the best and the brightest? I have enormous respect for teachers, but as the pool gets smaller of who's applying for jobs, what's that doing to the quality and the talent of that pool? And that's something to be really concerned about.
Jamie, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Joe in Eau Claire. Joe, hi.
Hi. I just have a quick comment or a question, I guess. I'm currently a science education major at a university in Wisconsin, and I'm really excited about being a teacher, kind of a facilitator of learning in the near future. My comment is, with the lack of funding, I'm kind of curious as to what are people really expecting, whether it's a Republican side or a Democratic side or any side of the aisle, what are people expecting in the next 20 years? If we don't fund education, what kind of society are we going to have? How are we going to have a future anything, future engineers or future people in politics or any sort of leadership in the future? I mean, it's all facilitated by education. So I guess that's where my confusion comes is how do you not fund this? Where are you going to be in 30 years if we don't have educated individuals?
Joe, thanks for the call. And Alan, are people in the schools, people from outside analysts, worried that we're cut to the point, that this teacher shortage is at a point where it's starting to affect the actual quality of education that Joe says is going to affect us, you know, as kids graduate over the next 15, 20 years?
Are they worried about this? Yes. Is it hard to pin down exactly what that means? Yes, you're seeing increased class sizes in some districts in the state. You're seeing fewer adults overall in the building. The adult-to-student ratio is changing and not favorably. I talked to a school official in Pewaukee, the other day, and we were talking about high school rigor, and he said, I spent a lot of my time thinking about what is the class of 2030 going to need and not just the class of 2017. Well, the class of 2030 is actually in school already. That would be this year's four-year-old kindergartners. So it isn't such a distant question, and the long-term impacts are something to really be thoughtful and concerned about.
Thanks for that call. As we talk to Alan Borsuk about the state of education in Wisconsin, we go to Nancy in Grafton next. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I understand that 40% of those charter schools here in the state have gone bankrupt. They're no longer operating, and they got a heck of a lot of money from the taxpayers. And how are we going to change that? We should not have that kind of functioning schools or malfunctioning. Thank you.
Nancy, thanks for the call. The state of charter schools, Alan, and how they fit into this.
If you got another hour, it's a very complicated subject. And some of the best schools in the state are charter schools. Some of the worst schools in the state were charter schools, and many of them are gone. My own feeling is a lot of it has to do with good control of who gets to open charter schools. Good authorizing would be the term. They do get less per student than a general public school does, but does that weaken a public school district financially? You could have a really long debate about that. Really complicated subject, and then we get into private school vouchers, which are kind of the partner to that.
Yeah, we've got a caller on the line, Phil, who I don't know if we'll have time to take him. He says vouchers are the answer to school funding, a better alternative to property taxes. I mean, that's again, a huge, long answer, but the role of
I'll give you a quick answer to that.
Go for it.
It is a very complicated subject, but the quick answer to that is I'd feel a lot better about vouchers as the answer, if there was any evidence in Milwaukee, anything more than very modest evidence in Milwaukee, which has now a 26-year history of vouchers and an almost 20-year history of really expanded vouchers, that it raised the level of educational achievement. The truth is the voucher schools overall and the Milwaukee public school system overall have about the same levels of achievement.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Alan, I'd asked Tony Evers about the idea of revisiting the basic school funding formula, big, complicated thing. Is there any likelihood that that's going to happen in the next 5-10 years or our lifetimes, maybe?
Well, without getting to the merits of the discussion, because there are merits, certainly, I think politically that's very unlikely. It's just so ingrained. When Jim Doyle became governor in 2003, he named a task force to look at this subject. They came back with some fairly thoughtful recommendations, and nothing was ever heard of it again because it's just so tough to change this. It's so ingrained, and it is so complicated.
We'll leave it there for now. Alan, thanks, as always, for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
That's Alan Borsuk. He's a senior fellow at the Marquette University Law School, longtime education writer. You can follow his work in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the state of education here in Wisconsin. We also heard from a state superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers. Yesterday, he delivered his state of education address at the Capitol. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.